Well, let's turn to Revelation chapter 17. Just going to read from verses 9 to 14 this evening. Revelation 17, verse 9. Here is the mind which has wisdom. The seven heads are seven mountains on which the woman sits. There are also seven kings. Five have fallen, one is, and the other has not yet come. And when he comes, he must continue a short time. The beast that was and is not is himself also the eighth, and is of the seven, and is going to perdition. The ten horns which you saw are ten kings, who have received no kingdom as yet, but they receive authority for 1 hour as kings with the beast. These are of one mind, and they will give their power and authority to the beast. These will make war with the Lamb, and the Lamb will overcome them, for he is Lord of lords and King of kings, and those who are with him are called chosen and faithful. Okay, so you'll recall the other week we began thinking about this kingdom of the beast, the beast's kingdom. And there are, as I pointed out, I think a few weeks ago, in a sense, there are two sides to the beast's kingdom. There is that which I'm going to call the political side, ruled over by the one the Bible calls the first beast in Revelation 13, verses 1 to 8. And he rules with 10 other, well, it calls them kings in this passage. They are leaders. And I'm going to call them the G10 leaders. Okay? Because effectively that's what they'll be. That's what they'll be in their time, the G10 leaders. And they'll rule over regions of the world for him and with him in that sense. So that's like the political side. But there's also a religious side to his kingdom. And the one who heads that up and sort of rules over that for him is the one Revelation 13 verses 11 to 17 call the second beast. And he's also known as the false prophet. That's in Revelation chapter 19 verse 20. And so next week we're going to start to look at that religious side of his kingdom, which is actually very, very important in terms of trying to identify what this kingdom is. I think I finished off last time by asking you the question, is there any such beast in the world today? Is there any such federation of nations coming together? And sort of left that open to you and suggested I might answer that this week. Well, I'm not going to this week, because I think what will help us is looking at not only what we're going to see this week, but when next week we start to look at the religious side, it should start to click, okay? So what I want us to do this evening, I want us to really finish off what we started looking at last time, and that is the political side of the beast's kingdom. And you'll recall, last time we were thinking about, we began by thinking about what Jesus called the times of the Gentiles. And the times of the Gentiles, that is a reference to that period of time when God's people, the Jews, are given over into the hands of Gentile nations who rule over them, so that they can no longer rule themselves. They can no longer be, as it were, what God intended them to be in the first place. That is a theocracy. That is to live in their own land under the kingship of God himself. But God handed them over, as it were, to the rule of the Gentiles. And that period that Jesus calls the times of the Gentiles in Luke chapter 21 began around 605 BC when King Nebuchadnezzar of Babylon came to Jerusalem and defeated Jerusalem and began to carry away the Jews into captivity. I think altogether there were at least three deportations of Jews over the next 18, 20 years or so off to Babylon. And the Babylonians began to rule over them in 605 BC. So that was when the times of the Gentiles began. And it will continue, the Bible says, until Christ returns at the second coming. Until then, as it says in Luke 21 verse 24, Jerusalem will be trampled by Gentiles until the times of the Gentiles are fulfilled. And that's what we see today. There are Jews living in the land, but it's actually trampled by Gentiles. And I know that Israel is a sovereign state right now and governs itself, but actually the Gentile nations are really pulling the strings in some way or another, aren't they, to some extent. So Jerusalem is still trampled by Gentiles, and it will continue to be so until the times of the Gentiles are fulfilled, according to Jesus, and he should know. So the beast kingdom will come right at the end of this times of the Gentiles. In fact, it will be the last 7 years of the times of the Gentiles. And you'll remember last time, if you were here last time, you'll remember we looked at a couple of the prophecies in the book of Daniel. And we saw there that the prophet Daniel was shown that four particular kingdoms would arise during this these times of the Gentiles, in succession, one after another. And those four kingdoms were the kingdoms of Babylon, Medo-Persia, Greece, and Rome. And it's revealed to Daniel how that the Antichrist, as we call him, the beast, would arise out of the fourth kingdom. That is the kingdom of Rome. And if you want a particular scripture that states that definitely, then Daniel chapter 9 and verse 26 says, halfway down the verse, the people of the prince who is to come. Now this prince who is to come is the Antichrist it's talking about here. The people of the prince who is to come shall destroy the city and the sanctuary. So you simply got to ask yourself the question, who destroyed the city of Jerusalem and its sanctuary? I'll give you a clue. It happened in AD 70, and it was the Romans. So basically that is saying the prince who is to come will be of that people. He will arise out of the fourth, the Roman kingdom. And his kingdom, the beast kingdom, will be a sort of outgrowth or final form of the fourth kingdom, the Roman Empire, effectively. And as I said, it will be the last 7 years of the times of the Gentiles, and it will be destroyed at the end of those 7 years by Christ at the second coming. Okay, so that's kind of what we were looking at last time. But here's the problem with all of that, as far as some people are concerned. See, some people would argue that the Roman Empire has already ended. When you learn about the Roman Empire at school, you're learning about ancient history, aren't you? So some people would say, well, look, the Roman Empire has already ended. It ended in 476 AD, to be exact, when Rome was invaded by various barbarians and Visigoths, and so that's when the Roman Empire came to an end, 476 BC. So how can this beast's empire be something that's yet future if it is the final form of the Roman Empire, since the Roman Empire ended in 476 AD. Do you understand the problem? But actually, if you talk about the Roman Empire coming to an end in 476 AD, I would argue that that isn't strictly true. For a start off, by that time, actually quite a long while before 476 AD, the Roman Empire had already divided into two, East and West. Thus, and here incidentally is the absolute accuracy of God's word. Because you remember that statue in Daniel chapter 2, and it's this huge statue, and it's made up of various metals, and the head is a head of gold and represents Babylon. The arms and chest are of silver, and that represents the kingdom of Medo-Persia. And the belly and thighs are of bronze, and that represents the kingdom of Greece. And then the legs and feet are made of iron, and that represents Rome. And there are two legs. Surprise, surprise. And there is the accuracy of God's word, because the kingdom of Rome divided into two, East and West. And so the western part of the empire had its capital in Rome. And it's quite correct to say that in a sense that came to an end in 476 AD, because the last Roman emperor, a man called Romulus Augustulus, was forced to abdicate his emperorship in 476 AD, and actually he was packed off to live out perhaps the rest of his days in a villa near Naples, which is perhaps not a bad place to kind of live out your life, but that's where he went. And and the invading army was headed up by a man called Odoacer, who was a Germanic warlord, and he proclaimed himself king of Italy. And so, in a sense, that's where historians say the western part of the Roman Empire ended, 476 AD, and the last emperor was dethroned and packed off to Naples. The eastern part of the empire, however, had its capital in Constantinople, which is present-day Istanbul, and became what was called the Byzantine Empire. And the Byzantine Empire continued until 1453, which is a long time after 476 AD. It continued until 1453, when it fell to the invading Muslim armies and became the Ottoman Empire. But you see, even if you come back to the western part of the Roman Empire that had its capital in Rome, I would want to argue that even after the last emperor had been deposed and packed off to Naples, kicked out in 476 AD, and the empire fell to these barbarian invaders, I would put it to you that the Roman Empire didn't end. It didn't end. It continued on in various other forms. That's what I would want to argue. For a start off, certainly its influence continued in all sorts of ways, not least in terms of its methods and styles of government. They continued on, especially within the so-called Western civilization, parliamentary democracy, the Senate in the USA, you know, the way the EU is run, the way to some extent the UN is run, really finds its origins actually right back in Greece, but certainly and mainly in Rome, and has continued ever since. Still, here I'm really thinking particularly about a Roman Empire that was ruled over by a supreme leader with immense power, in ancient times called an emperor, but afterwards not necessarily called an emperor. And I would want to suggest that even after the last actual emperor was deposed, that carried on in a different form. So, coming to Revelation chapter 17, I want us to look this evening at verses 9 to 11, which is actually a rather difficult passage. I mean, when I was reading that before, I wonder what you were thinking. I mean, especially when you get to verse 10 and 11. There are also seven kings. Five have fallen, one is, and the other has not yet come. And when he comes, he must continue a short time. The beast that was and is not is himself also the eighth, and is of the seven, and is going to perdition. Kind of reads like a riddle, doesn't it? It reads like a sort of conundrum that's got to be worked out. As a matter of fact, I think that's one of the most difficult sections in the book of Revelation, me. I really do, because of the way it's written. It reads like a kind of riddle. And it's why it says in verse 9, here is the man which has wisdom. What it's saying is you need wisdom to understand this, and I don't claim to have wisdom. But thankfully, it tells in James chapter 1 that he who lacks wisdom can ask of God, and he gives it. Okay, so I'm not claiming to have wisdom this evening, but what I want to do is I want to suggest to you a couple of interpretations of this, and a couple of suggestions that I think have merit, and you can decide what you think. Okay, so let's, here's the first one then. Okay, so what we've got to remember is chapter 17 of Revelation is begins, and it concerns this woman who rides the beast. Let me just read verses 1 to 6. It says, "Then one of the seven angels who had the seven bowls came and talked with me, saying to me, 'Come, I will show you the judgment of the great harlot who sits on many waters, with whom the kings of the earth committed fornication, and the inhabitants of the earth were made drunk with the wine of her fornication.' So he carried me away in the spirit into the wilderness, and I saw a woman sitting on a scarlet beast, which was full of names of blasphemy, having seven heads and ten horns. The woman was arrayed in purple and scarlet, and adorned with gold and precious stones and pearls, having in her hand a golden cup full of abominations and the filthiness of her fornication. And on her forehead a name was written, Mystery Babylon the Great, the mother of harlots and of the abominations of the earth. I saw the woman drunk with the blood of the saints and with the blood of the martyrs of Jesus. And when I saw her, I marveled with great amazement." And this actually connects really with that religious side of the beast's empire. And so, as I said earlier, we'll be coming back to this next week, and we'll start to look at this in a bit more detail. So the passage really has to do with the religious element. But look at verse 9 now. And it says, "Here is the man which has wisdom. The seven heads are seven mountains or hills on which the woman sits." And it seems to me that that is meant to identify this kingdom, the kingdom of the beast, from a geographical point of view. So, does anybody know which city in the world is known as the city set on seven hills? Rome is called the city set on seven hills. So, it seems to me what that verse is trying to show us is the identity of this. And of course it links back with the fourth kingdom is the kingdom of Rome. And it's the final form of that from which the Antichrist's empire will arise. So it's Rome. It's identifying it as Rome. But now look at verses 10 and 11. And this is the hard bit. "There are also seven kings. Five have fallen, one is, and the other has not yet come. And when he comes, he must continue a short time. The beast that was and is not is himself also the eighth, and is of the seven, and is going to perdition." Okay, so there are also seven kings. And these seven kings are not to be confused with the ten kings of verse 12. You see, the ten kings of verse 12, we are told, coexist with the beast, and they rule with him at the same time, don't they? See, the ten horns which you saw are ten kings who have received no kingdom as yet, but they receive authority for 1 hour as kings with the beast. So they're going to rule with him at the same time. Whereas, if you look at verses 9 and 10, these seven kings, this refers to seven kings that all reign or have reigned in their own time. For example, in verse 10, it says, five have fallen. In other words, they've already been and gone at the time of writing. John wrote Revelation round about 95 AD. So by 95 AD, five of these kings have already been and gone. They've already fallen. Yeah? With me so far. And then it goes on to say, one is, so that's the sixth. One is, in other words, still in existence at the time of writing, circa 95 AD. One is still around. And then the other, the seventh, had not yet come at the time of writing. Do you see? Okay. So we'll leave the eighth for now to try and save a bit of confusion. So let's ask a question. Who are these seven then? Five had fallen at the time of writing, one still was, and one had yet to come. Who are they? Well, as I said, there are a couple of possibilities that I think have merit, and I'll leave you to decide which you think. Okay, so the first explanation, the first suggestion, is that these seven kings are not seven kings as in terms of individual men, but they are seven types of governmental rule. Do you see? Seven different types of governmental rule adopted by Rome during its very long history. So at the time of writing, 95 AD, five had already fallen, been and gone. Different types of rule had already been and gone. And they were, as a matter of history, they were kings, consuls, dictators, decemvirs and military tribunes. All right, so we know what kings are. What are consuls? Well, a consul is a Roman magistrate comparable with a prime minister or a president. The consuls were the chairman of the Senate, which served as a board of advisors. They also commanded the Roman army, both had two legions, and exercised the highest juridical power in the Roman Empire. So that's what a consul was. What about decemvirs? That's not a word you use in everyday language, is it? Well, decemvirs were a kind of commission of 10 men established in the Roman Republic. And according to the information I've looked up, the most important were those of the two decemvirates who reformed and codified Roman law during the conflict of the orders between ancient Rome's patrician aristocracy and plebeian commoners. And interestingly, it says of the first decemvirate, it says that took office, remember the 10 men, these, took office in 451 BC. And their rule was fair, and their administration of justice was exemplary. Despite not being subject to appeal, they yielded to one another when an appeal was taken. They drafted their laws on 10 bronze tables and presented them to the people, asked for feedback, and amended them accordingly. They were approved by the higher popular assembly and the assembly of the soldiers. But the second decemvirate, well, what happened here was many men canvassed for election to the second decemvirate. According to Livy, Appius Claudius rigged the election and announced the election of himself and 9 men who were his supporters. This sounds like politics of our present time, doesn't it, really? This new decemvirate became tyrannical. They conducted trials behind closed doors and issued arbitrary judgments. There were rumours that they wanted to rule perpetually. Everyone hated them. So decemvirs were simply 10 men who ruled together. Okay? And so the first five kinds of rulership, again, they were kings, consuls, dictators, decemvirs and military tribunes. And at the time of writing in 95 AD, they had all been and gone. They'd all had their time. One is, that is the sixth, was still in existence at the time of writing. And that was the imperial emperor. The first imperial emperor of Rome was Julius Caesar. And at the time of writing Revelation, the emperor was Domitian. And he was the man who ruled at the time. So at the time of writing, it's the imperial emperor, and he's the sixth. But one was still to come. One had yet to come. And this was the seventh form of governmental rule over the Roman Empire. And at the time of writing, 95 AD, hadn't yet arrived. So what was it? Well, the fact is that Rome continued to be ruled by emperors right up until its last emperor in 476 AD, when that German warlord kicked him out. So Roman emperors continued right on to the end in that sense. Some of them were strong, some of them were weak, some of them were delusional madmen, but they were all emperors nonetheless. So what was this seventh form of rule over the Roman Empire which hadn't yet come in the time of John, who wrote Revelation, and still hadn't come by the time the last Roman Empire was ousted? I put it to you, it was that form of rule that has continued to reign over a Roman Empire even after the last emperor was gone. Because the Roman Empire did carry on. And we all know it, don't we? And I'm not talking about the Eastern Byzantine Empire either. I'm talking about in the West. it continued on in another form. In fact, in its new form, after the last emperor, it actually became bigger, eventually, and more powerful than it had ever been in the days of the ancient Roman Empire. And it became known as the Holy Roman Empire. And it was ruled over by the popes. And the popes were men who wielded immense power over a kingdom whose boundaries stretched way beyond anything known in the ancient Roman Empire, ruling over the souls and bodies of men and women, even kings, exercising great power over them. Here's a couple of quotes from Roman Catholic authorities. Okay, this is a quote from Pope Nicholas I, and he said, "Fear then our," this is a Pope speaking, okay? "Fear then our wrath and the thunders of our vengeance, for Jesus Christ has appointed us, the popes, with his own mouth, absolute judges of all men, and kings themselves are submitted to our authority." That is the Pope speaking. Here's Padua Provost and Professor Carrario, 1626, said, "The Italians are exalted above all nations by the special grace of God, who gives them, in the Pope, a spiritual monarch," king in other words, "who has put down from their thrones great kings and yet mightier emperors, and set others in their place, to whom the greatest kingdoms have long paid tribute, as they do to no other, and who dispenses such riches to his courtiers that no king or emperor has ever had so much to give." That's what the Pope said in the 1600s. So, you see, these popes were bigger than emperors, more powerful than the most powerful emperor in the ancient Roman world, by far. Papal rule, then, I put it to you, is the seventh form of governmental rule over the Roman Empire. But notice now verse 11. "The beast that was and is not is himself also the eighth, and is of the seven, and is going to perdition." The beast that was and is not is himself also the eighth, and is of the seven. Okay. So, remember now, we're talking here about the Antichrist, the beast who is to come, who will rule over this final form of the Roman Empire. He is the eighth, it says, but he is of the seventh. Actually, it's not as difficult as it seems. See, all it's saying is the beast's empire, remember, it's the Roman Empire, was. It used to be, and we all know that. We all went to school and learned about it. It used to be, didn't it? They built Hadrian's Wall. You can travel 100 miles north and you can visit it yourself. It used to be. But right now, is not. It's gone. Or at least, that's how it appears. But it is coming back. And it will be ruled over again by one who will be like one of the seven. Are you with me? One of the seven we've just been thinking about. One of the seven kinds of rules it had before. Remember, there were kings, consuls, dictators, decemvirs, military tribunes, the imperial emperor, and the popes, if this interpretation is correct. So all this is saying is when this Roman Empire comes back in its final form as the beast's empire, and he, the beast, the Antichrist, begins to rule over it, he will be of the seven who existed before, like them. His rule will incorporate elements of all those previous systems in some way or another, but he himself is like one of them in particular. You know, it's interesting, it only just dawned on me when I was looking at this week. When I say that his rule will incorporate elements of all those different styles that went before, see, look at Revelation 17 and verse 12. It says, The ten horns which you saw are ten kings who have received no kingdom as yet, but they receive authority for 1 hour as kings with the beast. Remember what we're saying about Decembers? They were ten men appointed to rule. And principally what they are famous for in ancient Rome, the first two Decemvirates, is that they codified the law. They wrote and codified the law of Rome at the time. And if you go back to Daniel and chapter 7, speaking about the Antichrist, there's a little almost throwaway statement there that I don't know, this, maybe this connects with this. It says in verse 25, "He shall speak pompous words against the Most High, shall persecute the saints of the Most High, and shall intend to change times and law." He's going to rewrite law. Well, that's what the Decemvirs did in ancient times. They rewrote law. So you see, what I'm saying is, there'll be elements of all those styles of government in his, but he will have the type of rulership of one in particular. And clearly, the one he will be most like is the imperial emperor, the absolute monarch. But he will also have his pope figure too. One who heads up the religious side of the kingdom in his name. And that is the false prophet or the second beast. Start to look at him next week. So there you are. That's one interpretation of this. That it's identifying really Rome as being the beast kingdom. The other view that some people hold is that the seven kings referred to here in verse 10 is a reference to seven kingdoms or powers which historically have ruled over the nation of Israel and oppressed them in its long history. And so at the time of writing, five had fallen, five had been and gone, and they were Egypt, Assyria, Babylon, Persia and Greece. They all oppressed and ruled over Israel at some point or another. One is, at the time of writing, and that was Rome. At the time of writing, Roman Empire was the world power. One had yet to come, and that is the rule of the popes. And the eighth who is to come, which is one of the seven, is the Roman Empire, revived in the last days as the beast kingdom and over which he will rule. But is also a sort of composite of all of them that went before. There'll be elements of all of them in it, which, although very different in many ways, Egypt very different from Babylon, very different from Rome, all had many differences, also they all had certain things in common. Whether you're looking at ancient Egypt or ancient Rome or Greece, they all had one thing in common. The main thing they had in common is they did not regard the true God and his Christ. And you can see that in Psalm 2. The Lord speaking of the kingdoms of this world. He says, "Why do the nations rage and the people plot a vain thing? The kings of the earth set themselves, and the rulers take counsel together against the Lord and against his anointed, saying, let us break their bonds in pieces and cast away their cords from us." See, all of them did not regard the true God of the Bible or his Christ. They were all built by man for the glory of man. And all of them influenced and energized by the dragon, or Satan, who from the very start has been working to build a kingdom for himself. A kingdom for himself over which he can rule in the person of the one he places on the throne. That will be the Antichrist. And that is why, you see, the beast kingdom also has this religious side. Because as we saw a few weeks ago, Satan has always wanted worship. He wants to be worshipped as God. Okay, so there you are then. Two explanations, two interpretations of what I think is one of the most difficult passages in the whole of Revelation. So you take your pick. But actually, whichever of those two you do think is best, the conclusion is still the same. And the conclusion is that a kingdom which contains elements of every godless kingdom of man that ever existed is coming. It's coming. And it will be, in every real sense, a revised version, a revived version of the Roman Empire, ruled over by someone whose power and authority will be like that of the imperial emperor, the absolute monarch with absolute power. And he will reign in the latter days with 10 others, who initially are elected heads. They've been elected into position. But then he places them, he gives them authority over 10 regions. 10 regions, not just within the compass of the ancient Roman, the boundaries of the ancient Roman Empire, but actually globally. Regions of the earth. It's global in scope. And it will be a political kingdom, but it will also have a religious element to it. Yet that religion is not the true religion. It is a blasphemous counterfeit religion with a blasphemous counterfeit Christ. And its origins go back to Babylon, which is what we're going to be looking at next week. So, at the end of last time's Bible study, I asked the question, does such a beast exist in the world today? Does such a kingdom exist in the world? Well, some think it's the EU, or at least some form of the EU, whatever the EU develops into. Some people think that is going to be the Antichrist kingdom. Some think it's the UN, the United Nations, or whatever that develops into. As I said earlier, what I want to do is I want to look at the religious element to all of this, because I think that gives us some clues. I think we've already got some in terms of the identification of Rome, but we're going to look next time at the spiritual side of the kingdom and see where that that leads us. So we'll leave our study at that for tonight, and let's just, shall we have some time of prayer now?